And I understand that the government attorney is on the telephone. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Michael Kagan. I represent the petitioner, Juan Castillo. This is a Convention Against Torture case. And actually, if I could stop for a moment, I will want to reserve 2 minutes of my time. I apologize. This is a Convention Against Torture case. And in this case, both sides agree that Mr. Castillo is at some risk, but the Board of Immigration Appeals concluded that it was not enough. And in reaching that conclusion, the board made two significant legal errors in addition to distorting the record and ignoring some really key parts of the record. The first legal error is demanding a certain number of confirmed cases of torture in a category that we don't think has been expected in previous torture cases. But the broadest legal error that I want to spend the first part of my time talking about is the failure to aggregate risk as required by this court in Cole and in subsequent cases. Mr. Castillo is in a uniquely dangerous situation in El Salvador. He has many risk factors, some of which are right on his body and others are easily discoverable. He's also in danger from many parties, both different parts of the government, different branches of the police, and from two different gangs, as well as from government-sponsored vigilante groups. The bottom line question that has to be asked is whether this one man would be tortured, which requires aggregating those risks and risk factors together. But what the BIA and the IJ did was to parse them, to separate them all out, find flaws with each, and then to say it didn't quite meet the level. Even doing that, the BIA and IJ acknowledged that there was some significant risk. A key part of that analysis, particularly in the critical rejection of the conclusions of the expert witness by the immigration judge, was to rely on the chain of events analysis from the Attorney General's decision in JFF. That was an issue in Cole as well, and it was rejected. Chain of events analysis is certainly appropriate in a certain type of case, as it was there in a very attenuated string of circumstances. But in a case like this one, which is far more similar to Cole and to some others,
Could I just interrupt? So
sure.
I agree that the agency needs to look at aggregate risk, but I'm having trouble figuring out why you think it didn't, given that the BIA said we are required to assess the aggregate risk, that is, taking into account all possible sources of torture, and then goes on and applies that. So why do you think they didn't do that?
Well, they certainly said it. They said it several times. So the first part of my answer to your question would be that a catch-all phrase is not enough, as this court said in Cole. Our argument is about the application. The reason why we need the agency to give reasons is so we can look at their reasoning. And when we look at their reasoning, it's not aggregation of risk. It's separation of risk. There's no part of the BIA or the IJ decision where we can see them adding these risks together other than saying that, restating the test, restating the phrase.
Do you think that what they needed to do is say, we think the tattoos give a 15% risk? And I mean, do they have to put a number on each source of risk?
Not a number, certainly not. I think that would be impossible. But certainly have a discussion of, well, we have acknowledged that there is risk at the airport, and we've acknowledged that there's risk from police. We did not think that those individually reached enough, but here's why we think even taken together, they don't reach enough. Beyond that, there is an overall approach that I think is encapsulated by aggregate risk, which is the bottom line question: would this one man, in his unique situation, be tortured? And if you look at the way the BIA and the IJ describe Mr. Castillo, key points, they're not talking about Mr. Castillo, they're talking about Salvadorans with tattoos or deportees from the U.S., so he becomes very generic. And this is not a generic case. This is a case about one person in a uniquely dangerous situation in El Salvador. So,
Counsel, sure. One of the brilliant law clerks who assisted me also happened to have a PhD in neuroscience, so she actually did the probability through a mathematical formula. I mean, it can be done that way. If you're interested, it's 1 - 3/4 to the 4th power. If you assign 25% as the risk in each of the three categories. She was making the point that you could have moderate to low risk of in three separate ways, but you have when you aggregate, there is a mathematical formula to look at that. But of course, we're not dealing about with accurate figures. But what I mean, as a judge rather than a law clerk with a PhD in neuroscience, we don't think that way when we're aggregating. We're not thinking about did we get above 50% or not. So how do we know that the IJ and the BIA didn't do what they were supposed to do here?
Sure. The premise to your question, if I can say, was very intimidating. We know throughout our legal system that we say preponderance of the evidence is 51%. Maybe there's some type of case where you actually have an expert witness with numbers. That's very rare, and that's very rare in torture and asylum cases as well. I think what we need to look at is similar to what I said to Judge Friedland a moment ago, to look at the overall approach, that we want to look at how all of these risk factors and dangers work together to affect this one person, rather than to separate them all out. We don't need to say this one's 12% and that one was 24%, and then we use that algorithm, which I'll stipulate to. What we need to do is see an approach of saying, what is the situation of this one man? Not of all Salvadorans with tattoos, but this one man who's got a uniquely severe criminal conviction that was undoubtedly in a gang, has many markings of having been in the MS-13 gang and in another gang, where we have an expert witness who's given training to the government, who was taken as credible, saying the greatest danger to him is from the police. We need to look at that man.
But, so the BIA acknowledges that he's talking about a source of risk from authorities, gang members, and vigilante groups. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, many of the things you're saying the agency needed to do, it looks like it said it was doing at least. And so then if you're just saying, well, but they didn't add it up right, then I'm not quite sure how we can say that it's not enough evidence to support its decision when they did look at the things and came up with the idea that it's not 50%.
Well, if I can go into dangerous territory and take the math analogy, but a simpler form of math, I would say that what is in the BIA decision is similar to, say, an elementary school student learning long division who correctly writes the division problem. I think that the BIA does that. They state the summarizer correctly, and they state this is going to be aggregate risk. But then what they do after that is not division.
And how do we know that? Is that just because they got to the result that you don't like?
Not at all. We know that because actually there are, you know, many cases this court has decided where the agency simply fails to state a reason. This is really not one of them. There's fairly long, single-spaced explanations of they showed their work, but their work is legally flawed.
But so what is the flaw? Because, I mean, they say they're looking at aggregate risk. They are listing the risks. Where's the flaw?
Well, they take each risk apart, so it does no
How can we tell that?
Well, what they say, that this is a Salvadoran with tattoos or deportees from the U.S.
But how do we know that they're not just, like, referring to him in shorthand in those parts when they also list these other things about him? I mean, I'm not sure they have to, in every reference to petitioner, list every factor about him, or it would be a very long sentence describing him every time they reference him, right?
There's no part in the decision. I think that we are not supposed to imagine too much about what they were thinking beyond what they write. And they've written a lot. They have gone through each of these separate risks, parsed them, said each one does not measure up. Nowhere do they will say a summary phrase of aggregate, but they never say, even though we've acknowledged these fairly significant risks to him, we still think that somehow this is not adding up, especially given the case law that we have, that this is similar to cases that have been decided before. They found, remember, even in their chain of events analysis, the first step is undoubtedly going to occur, that he's going to attract a great deal of scrutiny. even with that, with cases like INRI GA, which was quite similar in terms of what will be discovered about someone once they attract scrutiny, the facts in Cole, which are not entirely identical but have a lot of similarities, the State Department reports there are quite similar in many ways. There's no part in the BIA or the IJ's decision where we see them doing the addition. And I would also say the overall approach is wrong. It is parsing out all the risk factors and say, well, tattoos alone are not enough.
Yeah, but if they went the other direction, you'd say, well, they didn't take care of all of the issues that I had before them. It seems like to me that if you take the IJ's reasoning and put it with the board, that it pretty well covers it. What is wrong with us considering the IJ's, the immigration judge's reasoning on the case, along with what the board said, to come up with a conclusion on the outcome of the case?
I think that you have to, actually, because, first of all, the BIA explicitly adopts the IJ's factual findings.
That's right, he did.
And I think in other respects, probably can't be understood without
looking at it. Well, you've been so far talking about what the board did and what the board didn't do, but you didn't talk about the IJ, which gave a very reasoned outline. And so why doesn't the combination of what the IJ did in making the determination together with what the board said sufficiently cover the issues that we don't need to send it back?
The crux of the IJ's decision was relying on chain of events analysis, which should not be applied in this way in a case where someone has multiple parties endangering them. There's about two pages of the IJ's decision, and it's simply applying the wrong case. Because it's entirely about matter of JFF, not about Cole. And that's in addition to the IJ rejecting the expert because he thought that the expert had exaggerated with this reference to extermination groups, something that turned out to already be in the record and then referred to in a future State Department report, which I think severely undermines that conclusion.
Was that your second legal argument, the rejection of the expert?
The rejection of the expert is really embedded in the aggregate risk question because, although I know that sounds like a factual question, it's the IJ reasons his decision by basically rejecting the expert's conclusion, and that's where he goes through repeatedly saying chain of events, matter of JFF.
So we've taken you over your time. I'll still give you a minute for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Juria Jones. I represent the Attorney General. And again, hopefully for the last time, I thank you for allowing me to proceed telephonically. It was petitioner's burden to show a chance greater than 50% that he will be tortured if removed. And the record in this case does not compel a conclusion that petitioner has met that burden. What the regulations require is that the board consider all evidence relevant to the probability of future torture. And that evidence includes evidence of gross, flagrant, of mass violations and other relevant information. So petitioner misconstrues that the agency was demanding sort of this magical number. There had to be evidence of gross, flagrant, and mass violations, and that's exactly what the agency looked at. With regards to whether or not the board didn't correctly aggregate, petitioner is correct that what Cole requires is that he must establish that taking into account all possible sources of torture, he is more likely than not to be tortured by or with the consent of the government. And petitioner is somehow misconstruing the agency decision. They were not treated as separate, divisible CAT claims. Rather, the agency looked at taking into account all the possible sources of torture that he provided. Petitioner himself said his individual...
So do you think petitioner needs specific numbers? I mean,
no,
how is the petitioner supposed to do this exactly?
For example, in this particular case, petitioner's individualized evidence of torture was that he had these various tattoos that were covered and some were removed, some partially removed, and that he's a former gang member deported from the United States. But he himself brought forth that the sources of his torture were these four distinct individuals. immigration authorities, the local police, vigilante groups, and gang members. So with his own claim, the agency had to, taking into account all the possible sources of torture, had to evaluate his claims of where torture could possibly take place. And when in that consideration, the agency mentioned all four factors that he identified, and they concluded that he had not shown a greater than 50% chance that he would be tortured. So the agency did not err by treating each potential source individually. Rather, it assessed petitioner's overall risk of being tortured and whether or not he established a greater than 50% chance that he would be tortured by any of those sources that he mentioned.
Well, the effort was made to make that finding with the expert that was called, Dr. Borman. And Dr. Borman made some very strong evidence presentation in his testimony as to what would happen if this person went back. But the IJ didn't buy onto that. That was, I take it, a credibility determination. Was there any, did the IJ consider anything other than Dr. Borman evidence in making the determination the IJ did, which was approved by the board?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The immigration judge, as well as the board, considered the country report, the human rights report that was provided by provided in the record, and the board even considered the most recent country report provided by petitioner in his appeal. So they did have, and as this court has held, country reports are often considered to be decisive in whether or not to grant CAT protection. So, you know, they, along with, they considered, and petitioner hasn't demonstrated that either the agency or the board failed to evaluate dispositive evidence or otherwise ignored or overlooked the evidence.
So the BIA said that the IJ found Dr. Borman credible. Do you think that's accurate?
I think it's accurate for the following reason. The IJ did not say that the expert witness was not credible. What the IJ said and what the board confirmed is that a lot of the testimony that provided by him was not corroborated with objective evidence.
Right, so it sounds kind of like the opposite, right? I mean, it seems like the IJ criticized him for exaggerating or saying things that weren't corroborated.
No, he didn't. He didn't say that he rejected him. He said that Dr. Borman, quote, exaggerated the risk of harm, close quote. That was the finding of the IJ.
Right, that's correct.
So then,
and that was based upon reviewing the record and the evidence that was provided. There was nothing in the evidence to support some of his exaggerated claims that he made.
So it's a little odd that the BIA then characterizes that as the IJ finding him credible, isn't it?
Credibility probably is too of strong of a word that the board used, but the crux of the point of what the board was saying is that the exaggerated risk that was provided in his testimony, there was no clear error in making that determination that some of it was exaggerated because the record does not reveal some of his testimony.
So what do we do if we think some of what the IJ said about the exaggerations was wrong? So in some places, it seems to me that the IJ has mischaracterized some of what the expert said in rejecting it. So if that's true, it might be true that some of what he said isn't corroborated, but other things that the IJ attributed to him, I don't actually find in his report. And it seems like the IJ was mischaracterizing the report in some places. So if that's true, what do we do?
But that doesn't compel the conclusion that petitioner has established a greater than 50% chance that he would be tortured. I mean, that is one of the evidence that was considered. But if you continue on, the crux of both the immigration judges as well as the board's decision and as well as this court has established is that country conditions alone and those reports can play a decisive role. And so, you know, if being able to draw two inconsistent conclusions from evidence doesn't prevent a finding that the overall determination is supported by substantial evidence.
And what in the country reports do you think is so dispositive here?
Well, as the immigration judge noted on, particularly on the last page of his opinion, on page, and this page, I think it's page 56 of the record, is that nothing in the record, in the State Department reports, conclude that there is a greater than 50% chance that petitioner would be tortured. And as well as there's nothing in the record that petitioner has established that he, individualized and particularized to him, that he is more likely than not to suffer torture. What particularly in there is that and the board acknowledges that there are reports of this, but there's nothing in the record demonstrating that these instances are so pervasive, so gross, and so mass, which is what the regulations require, that it has to have a finding that there's a greater than 50% chance that he would be tortured if he is removed. I see I'm almost out of time, so if there are no other questions, then I'd like to conclude that this court should find that the record does not compel the conclusion that petitioner is entitled to CAT protection.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, in the brief time I have remaining, I'd like to highlight some issues about the corroboration and about what the IJ and BIA took from the State Department report, as well as some other evidence in the record. At a key moment, let me start with the State Department report. The IJ relied quite a lot on a reference to an inconclusive ombudsman investigations. I think the more important part of the report is the executive summary, which describes the civilian authorities failed at times to maintain effective control over security forces, refers to high levels of impunity and abuse. Other human rights problems included unlawful killings and cruel treatment of security forces. I think a reasonable reading of this compels thinking that what the State Department put in its summary probably should get the most evidence in an open-ended investigation. Also, the IJ stated regarding Dr. Borman describing the risk of abuse at the airport that was not corroborated in the record. That's not true. On page 884, this is in the of the record, that's in the Harvard report, it describes violation of deportees' rights occurred during the interrogation and searches that appear to be standard element in the reception process. Actually, there's several pages that go on there, but my point is that what the IJ took from the record in many cases just isn't either an accurate description of the sources or ignores extremely probative sources.
If you had a quarrel with the IJ, that should have been raised to the board when you went to the board. If you didn't raise it to the board, we can't accept it. Did you raise that issue to the board?
Yes, I think.
And what did the board say about that particular argument?
The board, to some extent, simply adopted the IJ's conclusions without discussing them, and otherwise simply repeated the IJ's conclusion. So we are now here. I think all of this was argued extensively at the board.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, both sides, for the helpful arguments. The case is submitted.